She was a beautiful woman, smart woman. She didn't need to travel those paths.
She was a mother of five with a double life.
She lived her church lifestyle and her online dating lifestyle.
We're talking about casual encounters with people who aren't using real identities.
Then she was murdered.
I'm appalled that she was found that way.
Somebody wanted to make a statement.
What would her life reveal about her death?
She had had communications with at least two other men.
He asked me, do you know who she was seeing?
From the shadows of the internet to the depths of the human heart.
He was very controlling and he was losing control.
December 1st, 2011. One of those days that make teeth chatter, joints creak, raw, damp, dismal. Austin Starbuck, then 21 years old, was nearing the end of his shift at a glass installation shop in Deer Park, Washington, half an hour or so north of Spokane, when his phone chirped. Text message.
Yeah, it's from Logan.
Logan, his younger sister at school.
Yeah, I remember she said that I'm cold, come pick me up.
But where was their mother? Wasn't she supposed to be there? Austin dutifully trooped around to collect his siblings as the cold gray afternoon darkened.
I couldn't take him to my mom's house because nobody answered her phone and I didn't know why I was getting in, so I just took him to my dad's house where I had a key.
Evening came. No word from mom. The kids called her cell. Not afraid. No, more like irritated. It had happened by then. Of course. Though as the children bedded down at their father's house, they never guessed it, wouldn't understand for days. That everything about life was different now, that nothing made any sense at all.
Unbelief. It was unbelief.
A friend named Summer Starks put the words to it. So impossible that she, of all people.
It was hard to wrap your mind around that it had occurred.
But apparently, it was possible. Shannon Starbuck, mother of five, was dead. Dead in a way that made skin crawl. And she had been so many things. Mother, artist, woman on the brink of something new.
Shannon was funny. She was vivacious. She liked to joke around and have a good time. But classy, always very, very classy.
Her two older sons, Austin and Blake, remember how she stood out, even if it embarrassed them a little, sometimes.
She would embroider our names and numbers on all the baseball team, all our hats.
We're the only team with her name and numbers on the back of our hats, you know.
Shannon tried to stitch her deep Mormon faith into their lives, too.
How was she with the kids?
I wouldn't hesitate saying she was a good mother.
This is their dad, Clay Starbuck, who was a boy on vacation from Alaska when he laid eyes on her in Florida more than 20 years earlier. Cold and hot worlds colliding.
I told her, you know, that I lived in Alaska, and she probably thought that she was lucky because she wouldn't see me again. I don't know how that...
But she did. They married within months and settled in Alaska, where Clay worked on the pipeline. Started a family right away. And there were issues. Aren't there always? Clay wasn't as interested in church. Not the way she was.
She wanted you to be there.
Yeah, I couldn't meet her there. It is a big issue. And I'm not sitting here saying I was right and it had to be my way or she was wrong. That's not an issue at all. We were different.
They divorced in 2000. Hot and cold. They'd lasted 10 years that time. Yes, that time. Full of hope and goodwill, they tried again. In 2006, they remarried, moved to Washington State, set up a house in Deer Park. And from there, Clay commuted up to his job in Alaska, which meant he had to be gone weeks at a time. So when he came home...
The kids and I were about playing catch, playing frisbee, playing basketball.
Having fun.
Yeah. So it wasn't uncommon to, I know Shannon said it several times, she'd make reference to me of being a Disneyland dad. And in her eyes, that probably that probably was true, because she was making dinners and taking care of the kids and trying to maintain the house.
Though it was up and down, good and bad.
Shannon and I never fully recovered.
It was 2010 when they filed for divorce the second time. They decided to live apart, but close to each other. He got a house near Shannon. The two eldest boys, Austin and Blake, chose to live with him. The three youngest stayed with their mom. That saw their dad a lot, especially during the last months of 2011. Clay was on disability, a back injury. He was home, his income vastly reduced, but at least able to share parenting, like swapping days for taking the kids to and from school.
I'd go over and pick up the kids and take them to school, and sometimes she'd pick them up and take them back, and we just, you know, it just worked out.
Or at least it did. Until that dismal afternoon, December 1st, 2011, the day Shannon failed to show up after school. Mind you, they weren't worried, said Clay. They all knew Shannon had started dating again, so maybe she went out, lost track of time. A mix-up.
So my thoughts weren't that anything serious happened to her. It was...
You thought she was with a guy.
I thought she was with a guy. I thought it just probably went late. They're having a good dinner.
But the next day, one of the kids texted Grandma, Shannon's mother, Melanie Borsier, in Florida. Had she heard from their mother? She had not. And that, said Melanie, was alarming.
I text Shannon, and I never got anything back. And I called, and her phone box was full, and I knew something was wrong.
She felt the panic rise in her throat, called Shannon's sister, Amy, and brother, Stephen.
She said it was very unlikely that Shannon wouldn't return her calls.
Because they spoke every day.
They talked every single
day. Every day, 9 o'clock.
They knew everything that was going on in each other's lives. So Mom continually tried to contact Shannon, tried talking to the kids, finding out what was going on.
Clay called the cops, asked them to check Shannon's house.
It was December 2nd in the evening. So it's, you know, find her.
Sheriff's deputies went over there, had a good look around outside, and left. But Shannon's family in Florida insisted something was wrong, had to be. And Shannon's friend Summer said she'd never not pick up her kids at school, then ignore their calls.
I knew that she doted on her kids. She loved them.
It was Saturday morning before Shannon's mother got through to the sheriff's office. And a deputy met Shannon's landlord, got him to open up the house. Two deputies went inside, and right away, radioed for backup. They had found Shannon. She was dead, her body on her bed, and displayed in such a way that detectives knew her killer had more than just murder on his mind. The crime scene would raise more questions than it answered. And so would a tip from someone close to Shannon.
He said, look at her phone and her computer. It will tell you what you need to know.
Flashing lights, squad cars, violated the peaceful neighborhood in Deer Park, Washington. Something big going down at Shannon's Starbucks house.
There's a bunch of crime scene tape and a bunch of detectives outside her house.
When Shannon's son, Blake, drove up to the street where his mother lived, he stopped cold.
It was obvious something bad had happened because it was like the whole yard was blocked off.
The awful news was beginning to spread beyond the now crowded street. When Shannon's friend Summer Starks heard, all she could think of was those kids.
Do they know? Do they know what's happened? Where are they? And I thought, oh no, they've just lost their mother. They've just lost their mom.
And thousands of miles away in Florida, Shannon's brother Stephen heard it first from the local sheriff and phoned his younger sister.
So I called Amy and told Amy, you need to meet me at Mom's. And she could tell something was wrong, and she started crying immediately. So I hightailed it to Mom's. We walked in together, and
he broke the news.
Looked at Mom and told her she was gone.
And I just backed up. And I screamed, no, no, it can't be true. But she was gone.
The detectives did not provide the ugly details, didn't tell anybody about that at first. That Shannon had been left mostly naked on her bed, posed pornographically with a sex toy. And before she took her last breath, Sheriff's Detective Mike Ricketts knew she suffered.
She was strangled. I believe she was tortured, and she was beat badly.
Inconceivable. Why would anyone do such a thing? And why her, when she was just starting over in life? After she and Clay called it quits that second time in 2010, she went back to school to become a dental assistant.
She presented herself in a very modest, a very conservative family woman sort of way.
These are Shannon's classmates. They looked up to her as sort of a cross between a den mother and an extra fun older sister.
She was like the epitome of what you would expect to see as a dental assistant. I was telling her about her big, beautiful teeth and her just and her magnanimous laugh and just the smile. I can still hear her laugh. I love it.
Very approachable.
And busy as she was, said her school friends, she always seemed to have time for, well, anyone who needed her.
She was very strong to be able to do that, because that is a very hard program.
Sure.
And
especially with children.
Yeah, with a family to tend to, and she was top of the class. What'd she do, graduate with honors or something?
Yes, she did. An excellent student with, finally, some prospects of her own. Her ex, Clay, said he was happy about that.
We were looking forward to her achieving her independence. Our whole family was.
Including you?
Absolutely.
But here was the strange thing. It seemed to her friends that Shannon was in some sort of crisis in the months before her death. She was upbeat one minute, distraught the next.
She's not public. You know, she doesn't want all her business known everywhere, but...
Thank God there aren't that many of those people left these days.
But, like, we would come into school and come in for class in the morning and stuff, and we would see her crying in her truck.
Was it her ex-husband? Her kids? Or maybe some new man? There were one or two. New men, that is.
And there were a couple times, you know, I'd ask her if she was dating, or she showed me a picture of this one guy, you know, her friend, that they would chat.
Met them online, said Shannon. Summer Starks was the one who encouraged her to get out there, get dating again.
I tried to set her up, but didn't work out. But she, I said, why don't you go date? Just go out.
Nothing serious, though. Not yet. Maybe she was finally having some fun.
And I thought it would have been great if she could have just focused on a little portion of herself, you know?
Have a
and
personal
lived a
relationship.
Little bit. Yeah. People just, you know, she deserved that.
Of course she did. And her love life wouldn't have been anybody else's business if it hadn't been for what happened. But now, detectives went digging into hidden places. People she saw in private, things she did she might not want the world to know. If there were secrets, and oh, there were, they were about to be exposed. One of those secrets was right here, on the dead woman's cell phone.
There was a text message to Shannon asking her to pose a specific way.
The pose? It was one investigators had seen before at the crime scene. If there is such a thing as a fate worse than death, then certainly someone seemed to intend that Shannon Starbuck met one. Lead Detective Mike Ricketts.
Shannon Starbuck was there, posed on her bed, in manner to bring disrespect to her.
And though Shannon Starbuck was now blessedly beyond embarrassment, her family and close friends, as you can well imagine, were not.
She had so much going for her, for it to all end like that. And especially the way it ended, that. Just she did not deserve that.
It was a very ugly
all.
Thing.
Yeah, and she did not deserve that whatsoever.
I'm appalled that she was found that way. You know, it's awful, and it's embarrassing for her. I'm, like, embarrassed for her. It makes me mad.
Who could be so cruel? Well, of course, it's the homicide detective's job to figure that out.
Could mean many things. It could mean somebody very close to her that was very upset and angry with her, or it could mean somebody else.
The investigation began the very day Shannon's body was found. And as luck would have it, among those just beyond the yellow police tape that night was a man the police surely would have looked up sooner or later. Didn't have to. Shannon's ex-husband Clay was clearly looking for them. What was going on? He wanted to know. His ex-wife was missing. Was she okay?
He was asking to talk to the lead detective. He wanted some answers.
First responders at the scene wouldn't tell him anything about what was found inside the house. Not even that Shannon was dead. An ex-husband, after all, is no longer next of kin. So Clay went down to the sheriff's station, where he met Detective Jim Dressback.
I said, well, come in. We need to have a chat. And his response was, well, your jacket says major crimes. What's going on? Nobody will tell me anything.
The detective broke the news. Shannon was gone. Waited for Clay to collect himself, and then...
I start by asking him very simple things. Give me a little bit about Shannon's history. Is she on medication? Does she have any enemies? You know, and what I ask everybody in that situation is, what do you think happened?
He asked me, do you know anybody that wants to harm her? Do you know who she was seeing? Do you know, were you over there? When did you see her last? Do you have any idea of these things?
Clay recalled telling the detective he knew his wife had been dating again. In fact, he was pretty sure, he said, that Shannon had a profile on a website that caters to Mormon singles.
I said, well, you know, last I knew there was a LDS Planet website, and I don't know. I don't have any idea who she's seeing. You'd need to look or talk to somebody else.
Oh, and they would talk to plenty of others. That was just day one of the investigation, and as a logical step in a case like this, the ex himself would have to be checked out thoroughly. But right then, the detective had no more for Clay Starbuck.
And I said, we'll talk to you again later. Why don't you go take care of your kids?
But even as he left the station, the detectives recalled, Clay Starbuck seemed eager to help.
He told Jim Dressback, look at her phone and her computer. It will tell you what you need to know.
Of course, no detective worth his salt needed to be told that. Shannon Starbuck's cell phone was right there in the bedroom. Couldn't miss it, said Detective Lyle Johnston.
The phone was sitting on a table that was right next to her bed, just a couple of feet away from her body.
Like she had just been using it or something.
Correct, right.
I wanted to look at the cell phone right away because it would tell us who she may have been in contact with last.
There was a text message from Clay from Thursday morning telling Shannon he had car trouble, asking her to take the kids to school. Then later some exchanges about who would pick them up. Not terribly interesting stuff, except that wasn't all they found on Shannon Starbuck's phone. And the what else that was there was very interesting.
She had had communications with at least two other men, and it appeared that she was planning on meeting with one or two of them.
Now that got the detective's attention. And then it fairly jumped at them, a particular text, a request, a very specific, very explicit one.
There was a text message that was to Shannon asking her to pose a specific way.
The hair rose on Rickett's neck. That was almost exactly the way the killer posed Shannon's body. A coincidence? The detective had to think it was anything but. Investigators took a hard look at two men Shannon seemed to have contact with the day of her murder. One guy posted a picture of himself, but...
We found that he had actually stolen it from another person's website, a doctor who lived in New York City.
Who was this mystery man, and what was he hiding? Strange, the small things that can offer comfort, however cold, in the midst of horror. Once, long before her death, Shannon told her mother how she wanted her funeral to be. Morbid talk back then. Now a blessing in the midst of so much grief.
So Mom was able to give Shannon what she wanted for a funeral, if that was something you really want.
Her old classmates went to the funeral and brought along the candy they used to share, cramming for tests.
I felt kind of silly, but I brought some to her funeral. But then I didn't feel so silly because somebody else had brought chocolate and set it up there too, so I didn't feel like I was the only one.
But nothing could sweeten the bitterness. Nothing.
The children were allowed to see her, and I remember one of them saying, he was looking at her and he said, it doesn't look like Mom. And I don't think he even recognized her.
That's how badly she'd been beaten. It made her family furious that someone did that to her. So in the days that followed, they seethed. Quite unaware that investigators thought they had a huge break in their hunt for her killer, lead detective Mike Ricketts.
They were normal text messages. Then they moved into more sexually suggestive text messages.
On the last day she was seen alive, Shannon exchanged text messages with men she'd apparently been seeing. Rocketing to the top of the list of potential suspects was the gentleman who sent her that sexually explicit text asking her to pose a certain way, take a picture, and send it to him.
It was alarming because the text mimicked somewhat what we found at the crime scene as far as Shannon being posed.
Shannon did not take or send a picture, but the request? That wasn't just a red flag to investigators. That was a cannon shot. Within a matter of hours, the detective had that man on the phone. After all, his number was right there in Shannon's cell.
I told him who I was and asked him if I could come speak with him, and he stated yes.
He was a car salesman from Spokane named Tom Walker, and in his recorded interview with sheriff's detectives, he told them he had nothing to hide.
I texted her and said, at 8:06, and I said, good morning, sexy. She texted me back 14 minutes later and said, good morning, handsome.
Walker admitted trying to sext with Shannon Starbuck that morning, but he denied that he had been anywhere near her house. He said he was at work and a funeral that day.
Were you at work all day Thursday?
Except for the funeral.
Except for the funeral?
Yes.
Did you have any involvement in her death?
No.
Investigators took a DNA sample and set about taking a hard look at Tom Walker's alibi. The problem was, they still weren't exactly sure when Shannon was killed. Besides, they still had lots of other people to interview. That's what happens in a murder investigation. Everybody gets pulled in, especially those closest to the victim. Detectives even called Shannon's eldest son, Austin, in for questioning.
When was the last time you saw her? You know, they asked me a little more how her relationship was.
Austin lived with his father and told the police that, yes, he was closer to his dad since his parents split up. And if the question seemed cruel, well, the adult son had to be looked at, eliminated if possible.
Does it feel weird to be put in a position of suspicion like that?
Yeah. He tried more leaning on me, like, did you do it? Did you do it? And it wasn't like, I know you did it. It wasn't like that. But he made me stand up, and I worked at a glass company. I actually cut glass, so you know I had some older cuts on my hands. And he's like, "Well, where'd you get that one from?"
Of course, they talked to the other man in the family too, Blake, then 18, and naturally the ex-husband, Clay. What was he doing on December 1st, the day Shannon went missing, the day she likely died?
He told me at that time that his car had broken down on High Desert Drive in Deer Park.
Clay said he spent the day fixing his car, never saw Shannon at all. So who, if anyone, was Shannon with that day? As detectives continued to dig, they found what might be an answer right there in Shannon's phone. A message from a different man, one named John Wilson. Wilson also seemed to be messaging Shannon on her phone using another name, Just Wondering 06.
And it appeared from the communications that they were trying to meet, set up a date where they were going to meet on December 1st, 2011.
The very day detectives believed Shannon was murdered. But when they traced that phone number from which this John Wilson called, they found themselves looking at a public payphone. But when they Googled the names John Wilson and Just Wondering 06, they found profiles on dating sites and on Facebook, and quickly realized this man wasn't who he appeared to be.
It was a pretty minimal site, though.
But a photograph purporting to be this John Wilson guy.
Correct. And we found that he had actually stolen it from another person's website, a doctor who lived in New York City.
So now you know that John Wilson is not the person you see on the screen.
Correct.
A phony picture. A phantom who was clearly interested in keeping his real identity a secret. But why? Exactly who was this latest mystery man? How do you track down a guy determined to hide? One detective would try his luck with an instant message.
I said, I need to talk with you about Shannon Starbuck. And I bet it wasn't 20 minutes my phone rang.
What's a 40-something single woman to do? If she's looking for a little romance, and who isn't? Why not press a button, type in your name, see what happens? Looked like that's just what Shannon Starbuck did.
I said, well, get online. And she says, I'm online. I'm online on a dating site.
It's not uncommon for
this day and age
to online date. So right. I don't know why.
And she wouldn't have put herself in danger or harm's way whatsoever.
Well, you wouldn't think.
No.
But in fact, that was something Shannon's children did worry about a lot.
I'm sure you know Dateline NBC, you know, and then To Catch a Predator, right? Uh-huh. You know, I've seen that, and it's where weirdos go on the internet. So we're all afraid that she was going to meet this one weirdo that was on the internet.
Now, those sons were eager for investigators to find their mother's killer. And detectives were, in fact, chasing down a new lead in connection with Shannon's internet dating.
If there's a murder investigation, there's no stone unturned.
Hiding under one particular rock was one very likely suspect. The man calling himself John Wilson, who planned to meet with Shannon on December 1st, the last day she was seen alive. Detectives quickly figured out that he was some kind of an imposter, had posted a fake picture in his online dating profile, and had been communicating with Shannon from locations clearly designed to hide his real identity.
They were all public places, public phones, universities, places like that.
Boy, this guy's been careful.
Right, he's doing everything from public locations.
What does all this sort of thing tell you?
Well, it caused us a lot of concern that this certainly could be our suspect.
They traced one of those payphones he used to call Shannon. It was here outside a university library. It happened to have a surveillance camera. Was this John Wilson? Only one way to find out. Detective Johnston sent him an instant message of his own.
Identified myself as being from the sheriff's office and said, I need to talk with you about Shannon Starbuck. And I bet it wasn't 20 minutes my phone rang.
It was him, all right. And yes, he told the detective he knew Shannon Starbuck. Yes, the two had been seeing each other. But
he was very hesitant to identify himself. I had asked him for his name, who it was that I was speaking to.
It sounded a bit shady to the investigator. Distrustful.
It was obvious that he didn't seem to believe that I was with the sheriff's office either.
Mike Ricketts was listening in on the conversation and scribbled a note to his fellow detective.
Tell him that we need to have his true identity shortly, or I'm going to post this picture and show it all over the media and I will find out who he is.
And at that point, he told me his true name.
Suddenly wanted to cooperate.
Well, he didn't really want to, but he expressed the fact that he had been having an affair. He was married.
That was his explanation for the fake name, the skulking around, hiding from his wife, he said. His name, his real name, was John Kenline. He was a school teacher. He agreed to talk to the detectives in person, but asked to have the conversation at the office of his lawyer, a man named Robert Cossey.
I mean, he's completely stressed out. He is completely worried about his personal life, his professional life.
This interview is done with your permission and your attorney's?
Yes.
So tell me, if you can, how December 1st panned out.
December 1st, the last day Shannon was seen alive, Detectives already knew the answer from messages on Shannon's phone. The man they were talking to had plans to meet Shannon at her house, but they wanted to see if he'd tell the truth.
At 10:30, I was at her house. I knocked on the door.
What he told us was that he had made prior arrangements to meet with Shannon.
So he actually went to her house?
He did go to her house.
Only she never answered the door, he said. So then he went to a public phone to call, left a voice message. He even stopped by her house again, frustrated, peered through her windows. Didn't see anything, he said. And then he told detectives he spent the rest of the day and into the evening exchanging messages with Shannon.
I texted her, and I got a text message in reply from her that said, did you come over? And she says something to the effect of, how about tonight or later tonight?
He really wanted to see her.
Right.
But never did. Or at least he said he never did.
Right.
There was, however, a problem with his story. For much of December 1st, John Kenline couldn't tell detectives if anyone had seen him. In other words, no one to really back up important portions of his alibi. Lead Detective Mike Ricketts didn't know what to think.
Here's an individual that's going to great lengths to hide his identity. But at the same time, here's an individual that is being as detailed as he possibly can and providing us as much information as he can. So I was on the fence, but it was someone that we had to investigate.
Boy, did they ever. To see if the school teacher, Shannon's mystery man, was telling the truth or trying to cover up a crime, detectives waded through all of his communications with her.
We didn't let the idea go that he could still be our killer. I don't remember the number of days, but it was a week or two after the homicide that we even realized Shannon had called 911.
911? Spokane County Sheriff's detectives were about to discover a new piece of evidence. It was a recording, eerie and garbled and fleeting, and it might just be enough to help solve a murder. A break and a shock.
It hit me really hard. It was like a rock in my stomach.
There is nothing quite like a murder to put the most intimate parts of life on public display. Investigators had tracked down two suspicious men Shannon was dating. One, a married teacher, was at her house on the day she likely died. The other sent Shannon a racy text message that almost mimicked the crime scene. They offered alibis, of course, but since the detectives didn't know exactly when Shannon died, they couldn't check them out. Funny how one little break can make all the difference.
It hit me really hard. It was like a rock in my stomach.
Detective Mike Ricketts wasn't expecting it, not at all, that piece of evidence that suddenly surfaced weeks into the case. His colleague, Detective Lyle Johnston, had just gotten a record of the calls dialed from Shannon's phone. And there it was, staring back at him.
The records that we get from the phone company reflect a 911 call.
A 911 call? 9:17 a.m., December 1st, not long after Shannon dropped the kids off at school. The 911 operator failed to properly file the call with the sheriff's department. And you may not know this, but some cell phones don't store 911 calls in their call list in effort to protect callers in dangerous situations, like somebody had been kidnapped, say. So all that meant detectives trying to solve a murder had no idea Shannon called 911 until they got the records from her wireless carrier.
Were you able to find out what was in the 911 call, how long it lasted, when it came?
Yes, they were able to, based on date and time, find a recording of the exact call.
It was just 28 seconds long. It started with a noise.
Could you hear it?
You could. And unfortunately for the 911 call operator, I believe he talked over it and he didn't hear it.
911, what are you reporting?
So brief, so garbled, but listening to it now, they became convinced this must have been Shannon as she was being attacked. 9:17 a.m.
911, what are you reporting?
Hello?
What it sounded like is if somebody was struggling over the phone, and you could definitely hear a female's voice kind of, and that's about all it amounted to.
But who was the attacker? The car salesman? The teacher? Or somebody else? Now the investigators had to go back over those alibis and compare them to the time of that 911 call. They started with the salesman, Tom Walker.
Were you at work all day Thursday?
Except for the funeral.
His phone never pings off any of the towers in the Deer Park region. He is at work on December 1st. He attends a funeral. We confirm that.
The salesman, the guy who sent that racy request for a photo, was in the clear. That left the school teacher, John Kenline. He admitted he was actually outside the Deer Park house that morning, 10:30. But in the hour before that, when it appeared Shannon was being attacked, according to the 911 call, he said he was not at Shannon's Starbucks house, but at a Starbucks in Spokane, getting coffee. A specific Frappuccino that the store happened to have a record of selling.
I heard that there was a great to-do about whether or not he ordered some very specific and unusual drink.
Correct. That is the case. He purchased coffee at about the same time that the 911 call had come in. Just a little variation in time. But well within the time frame that he couldn't have been at Starbucks and he couldn't have been in Deer Park at the same time.
And so, the man who once looked so suspicious convinced detectives he was telling the truth.
They looked at him every which way you could be looked at. They checked out every part of his story, and every single fact, everything that he told them, checked out 100%.
Now he just had to deal with his wife. And detectives, they went back through the list of possible suspects. Shannon's killer was still out there. A killer who, judging from the story Shannon's friends were telling, might have been building up to an attack. During the last 6 months of Shannon's life, said Summer Starks, her friend was convinced somebody was out to get her.
Shannon's house had been broken into quite a few times, and just minor things would be missing, or the barbecue would be messed up, knocked over, lights would be unscrewed. You could tell somebody had been in, but things weren't missing sometimes. Just odd things that you would notice just weren't right when you would come home.
Shannon filed police reports. The incidents were investigated, but never solved. Shannon had been accusing Clay.
Shannon thought Clay was behind everything that was happening, that he was either trying to scare her or trying to assess a way into her home.
But the police didn't find any evidence of that, and Clay said the idea was ridiculous. Besides, he said he was in Alaska when at least one of those strange disturbances supposedly happened.
At first, I was like, no way, I didn't do that. And then then the date hits me, and I'm like, well, for sure I didn't do that. I wasn't even here.
In fact, he said he and Shannon got along better than most divorced couples.
Shannon and I made things work. We would text or say, hey, I'll get the kids. I know next weekend is my weekend, but can you take them that weekend?
But now that Shannon was dead, detectives had to rethink her suspicions, as related to them by Summer. And she wasn't the only person who viewed Shannon and Clay's relationship through something other than rose-tinted glasses. Shannon's siblings, for example, who said Shannon accused Clay of cheating on her, claimed that was the reason for both divorces. And the last breakup was so nasty, they said, that in the months before Shannon died, Clay stopped paying child support.
We were paying her rent. We were providing food for her children.
She was going to the food bank for food.
My mother was paying for her school and her computers.
Fascinating how the issues of a divorce can seem to change depending on who's doing the looking. Now, the detectives were, and they were right back where they started.
A home surveillance camera provides a clue that reboots the investigation.
What did you think when you saw that?
Well, I thought that he was lying.
As detectives winnowed through their list of potential suspects in the murder of Shannon Starbuck, they at least began to make that kind of progress that comes from dead ends.
I was able to eliminate Tom Walker. I was able to eliminate John Kinline.
And so, one name they hadn't quite been able to cross off their list seemed more and more important.
Clay Starbuck was never eliminated as the suspect.
Clay Starbuck, the ex-husband. And by now, they had something else to consider. A slew of unflattering tidbits from Shannon's family.
He was just constantly trying to belittle her and make her feel like she was inanimate.
I always thought he was a creep.
And those dental school classmates were also eager to pass on a few of the stories Shannon told them about Clay.
He was always bugging her, I guess, if you will, wondering what she, you know, what are you doing, or can you do this, or just trying to keep her in the
tabs.
Yeah.
Shannon told them, they said, that Clay wouldn't leave her alone, was some kind of control freak. They didn't know Clay, of course, never met him, but their opinion went from bad to worse when Shannon came into school visibly upset one day, telling them that Clay sent her a gift, a sex toy.
It was in like a little gift bag, if you will, hanging on her doorknob.
With a note.
With a note from Clay.
That said,
here, enjoy. I can't have you, so you can have this, or something like that.
He was very jealous. He was very controlling, and he was losing control.
Still, said Summer, it seemed almost like a joke the first time Shannon wondered out loud if Clay might try to hurt her.
I told her to quit being so dramatic. She was kind of being a drama queen, and you know, that's ridiculous. I said, that only happens in the movies or on Dateline. And I just said, you're just so full of it.
But, according to Summer, Shannon was scared, particularly after the windows were mysteriously shot out of the car parked in her driveway. Shannon changed the locks in her house, didn't even give the kids a key, telling friends she was afraid Clay would find a way to steal a copy.
She was very vocal about her fear that he would kill her.
Hardly surprising. Those stories would tend to put a sinister spin on everything police observed about Clay. Starting with that very first police interaction the day Shannon's body was discovered. Detective Dressback thought something was off the moment Clay arrived at the station and he told Clay the news.
And he goes, oh my gosh, what happened to my wife? I said, well, she's dead. And his knees buckled and everything became very histrionic, crying and wailing. And that was okay for a while, but it became ridiculous. It became ridiculous.
Even more ridiculous, more suspicious, said the detective, was when Clay, told he was free to go, didn't.
Then I couldn't get rid of him. He would not leave me alone.
Kept wanting to talk.
He kept wanting to talk. And what he kept telling me was the same thing over and over again. Look on her phone, look on her computer, that'll tell you everything you need to know.
So what do you do with that? I mean, it's suspicious to you, but it's not really evidence, is it?
No, not necessarily. It's suspicious, it's circumstantial, but it's suspicious to me.
Which meant, of course, that right then on day one, Clay needed to be checked out, but good. And they began with his alibi for that December morning. Remember, Clay's day started with car trouble and his text to Shannon asking her to take the kids to school for him. He said he spent much of December 1st walking between his home and the spot the car broke down, about a mile away.
He told me that he had to go back and forth to his residence four times that day to work on his car and get tools, to eat, to take a nap.
But detectives couldn't find anyone along that route who remembered seeing Clay. And another odd thing, his cell phone was off for several hours, no pings to trace. But in the area Clay said he walked, a little shoe leather produced a stroke of luck attached to a house.
There was a camera on the side of the house.
A home surveillance camera pointed in the very direction they remembered Clay telling them he walked. And no sign of Clay, far as they could tell.
I mean, there is no indication that he ever passed by there that day.
What'd you think when you saw that?
Well, I thought that he was lying.
One statement that looked like a lie. One dead cell phone. A complaint about overdue child support and a bunch of tales about alleged threatening behaviors, which, try as they might, they couldn't verify. The detectives didn't have enough for an arrest, let alone a murder charge. They needed something more, something that tied Clay directly to the crime scene. And? Enter the DNA.
I believe it was January 24th, 2012, when I obtained the initial DNA report.
They had submitted several samples from Shannon's body for DNA testing. Thought the most important thing would be from her neck, where she was strangled, and her fingernails if she'd fought off her attacker. Some of the samples came back labeled unknown male, which didn't match any of the known suspects. But some other of the DNA material could be narrowed down to a very small pool of candidates. Starbuck male.
Clay Starbuck, or Austin Starbuck, or Blake Starbuck.
There was no getting around it. DNA didn't lie, after all. Detectives were now convinced that a Starbuck male killed Shannon. But which one? Was it possible one of Shannon's own sons killed her? Not a chance, said Detective Ricketts.
We obtained records that indicated they were at work and at school. We eliminated them as suspects.
Only one man left standing now. But not for long. On February 6, 2012, 2 months after they found the body of Shannon Starbuck, they arrested Clay and charged him with murder. It was the moment Shannon's siblings and mother had been waiting for.
When Clay was arrested, it was a big relief.
We felt as though Clay should have been arrested right off the bat.
I knew that he was the one that murdered her.
It was, of course, a victory for the detectives, too. But it came at a terrible price.
I didn't want it to be Clay Starbuck. I didn't want to take those children's father from them.
Shannon and Clay's five children, still in shock over their mother's death, now had another blow to absorb. Shannon's brother was especially worried about the three youngest in the family.
That means they have no guardian then. So we all decided that it would be best that we try to get custody of the kids and get them out of that situation.
But the Starbuck children weren't going anywhere. Austin, just 21, filed to be the guardian for his younger siblings so they could all stay together and fight together for their dad.
And it's hard to grieve, you know, over our mother when we're fighting for our dad's innocence.
Yes, they said. Their dad was innocent. And if that meant sacrificing their mother's good name to save their dad's, so be it. Shannon's private life was about to become very public.
We can verify at least 10 men that she was communicating with electronically, most of which she had met one-on-one.
A string of strangers, now potential suspects. At first, the arrest of Clay Starbuck for the murder of his ex-wife, Shannon, seemed to be playing out with all the predictability of a well-worn movie plot. In hindsight, it all seemed so obvious, at least to Shannon's close friends and family.
We knew that Clay killed her just because he had been stalking her and causing her so much grief. We knew what he did to her.
But you might be surprised to hear the Starbuck children weren't buying any of it.
So you believe that your dad is innocent of this?
Yes.
There's no way he could possibly have done this?
No.
Arguably the only witnesses with ringside seats to Clay and Shannon Starbuck's long-running drama were their five kids. And those kids, every single one, including the three youngest, Sutton, Marshall, and Logan, rallied to their father's defense.
He's innocent and he didn't do it. He's a nice, caring, loving person. I mean, why would you kill your ex-wife? You still love and leave all your five children parentless.
Yes. So often what a family looks like depends on who's doing the looking. The kids? All their lives they said it was their father who was the long-suffering one, not their mother. In fact, they said their mother, Shannon, was not always what she seemed to be. Over the years, they said, she would up and leave, taking them with her to live with other men. More than once. For months at a time. But they said their dad would always take her back.
Even through all this, he would always say he loved her. I remember just this, through this last divorce, he would say that, like, no matter what, he could forgive her and take her back.
The older Starbuck boys said it was patently obvious to them that the case against their dad was a frame-up from start to finish.
There is no physical evidence.
There were a couple times where I actually laughed out loud reading what they had said in there and how ridiculous the story is that they put together of what he did and how he did it.
None of it, they said, beginning with the DNA evidence detectives found so incriminating. That male Starbuck DNA, in all likelihood, they said, came from one of them, Austin or Blake. But it couldn't have come from the youngest, Marshall, who learned in the process that he was not Clay's biological son. Was conceived during a relationship Shannon had after their first divorce. Murder, as we say, exposes all kinds of secrets.
The evidence they have is trace DNA. It's like I go up to you and touch you on the hand.
Yeah.
It's that small.
But there is Starbuck DNA.
Yeah.
But and there are some who have said, well, if not him, what was it, one of you guys?
There's Starbuck DNA in the Starbuck house.
Yeah, kind of funny how that works, huh? We all live there, you know. My dad lived there months before this happened. Yeah, there's going to be just hair everywhere. There's going to be, you know, sweat.
The kids coming over clothing. Back and forth from our house to her house.
According to the Starbuck children, their father was essentially a victim of a kind of marital profiling. A suspect simply because husbands and ex-husbands of murder victims are always suspects. If not for that bias, they said, the investigators would have found the real murderer.
Evidence is shoddy.
And there are so many other possible suspects, they said. Take this theory of Blake's. Not long after Clay's arrest, there were news reports about a man named Israel Keyes. He was arrested for murdering a young coffee barista in Alaska and later admitted he'd killed many more people, some in Washington State. A serial killer whose family hailed from, of all places, a town just a few miles from Shannon's house. Well, why would you think it was Israel Keyes?
Because he has killed over 10 women. He admitted to 4 in Washington. He was arrested a month after my dad, so he wouldn't have been on the radar until then.
Serial killer? Maybe. But here's the biggest reason they don't believe their father is a murderer. It was the children's bombshell. Their mother had been keeping a dangerous secret, they said, a secret life. One Austin said he figured out when he was just 8.
She lived a couple different lifestyles. She lived her church lifestyle, her home lifestyle, and then her online dating lifestyle.
To hear the Starbuck kids tell it, their mom, known to most people as a prim and proper Mormon homemaker, lived a racy and risky personal life. A secret from even her closest friends and family. But impossible to hide from them, the kids.
It wasn't normal online dating. You know, it wasn't like she didn't meet some guy and be with him for, you know, 3, 4, 5 months to a year at a time. She was with him for, you know, just a short visit. You know, on to the next one.
Was it true? Sitting in jail awaiting trial, Clay told his public defenders, Derek Reed and Jill Gannon-Nagel, the same thing he said to sheriff's detectives. Look at her phone. Look at her computer.
The things that we were able to find and confirm on the laptop were not normal dating relationships. It was sexual relationships, and most of those relationships can be confirmed that they were only sexual in nature. And that includes...
And explicitly so.
Explicitly
sexual. With videos and photos and you name it.
Yes.
It was all there in the laptop. Evidence of trips to meet men she'd connected with online, but did not know in person until she made herself completely vulnerable to them, these strangers.
Several men. I don't think that we could even give a number of the amount of at least email addresses. And
what, are you talking 2, 3, 10, 15?
10 would be a minimum, I would say.
We tried to keep it as close to the incident as possible. And in November of 2011,
the month leading up to her murder,
we can verify at least 10 men that she was communicating with electronically, most of which she had met one-on-one. And we can verify that.
Every one of them a possible suspect. At least, that's what Clay's public defenders thought. Well, investigators had run down leads from Shannon's phone, the lawyer said. That crack team of detectives didn't follow up on any of the potential leads from her laptop.
It was there. They had it, right?
It was there. They swabbed it. They, in fact, at some point, somebody suspected something. And I'm not quite sure why they didn't follow up.
But isn't this all just a smokescreen? Because the evidence is pretty clear that Clay's Starbucks alibi doesn't hold up, and the alibis of those other people do.
The alibis of the ones they looked into.
So, armed with the evidence found on that computer alone, defense attorneys were confident they would instill in a jury, at the very least, reasonable doubt. And as the day of his trial approached, the Starbucks children were giddy with the anticipation that soon Dad would be coming home to stay.
I know he didn't do it. We need to fight for our dad's innocence, get him out, so we can go back and hit it on the head again and find out who did it and solve it.
At trial, the jury hears a prediction once made about Shannon.
He said, "I wouldn't be surprised if we found her dead with her throat slit open."
Every trial for murder has this simple question at its core. Whose version of the truth will the jury believe? And in the case of Shannon Starbuck, the two competing realities set for display could not have stood in starker contrast.
We've been waiting over a year for this moment.
I guess you could say I'm on a mission. I want him put away.
The divided family couldn't have been farther apart in the small Spokane County courtrooms when the trial began in May 2013. The prosecution set out to prove Clay Starbuck was a jealous, controlling, and ultimately violent man who murdered his devout and long-suffering ex-wife. While the defense prepared to argue that Shannon herself recklessly courted danger and quite possibly died at the hands of one of the many strangers she met online for sex. To Shannon Starbuck's friends and family, who heard in advance what the defense had planned, it sounded like an old-fashioned smear campaign.
That's all they had to go on. That's the only thing that they could turn Shannon into, was this awful person.
She wasn't a sexual deviant. She wasn't running around sleeping with everybody in Deer Park and Spokane.
The state presented its case first, argued in court by Deputy Prosecutor Larry Steinmetz. And he began not with sex, but with that other, less titillating root of all evil, money.
Do you saw me swear?
The jury heard from Summer Starks that Shannon didn't have any.
With respect to Ms. Starbuck's financial situation, how would you define that?
Dire.
Do you know whether or not Ms. Starbuck had been receiving any child support or spousal maintenance from Mr. Starbuck during that time period?
She had told me she did not.
Clay owed more than $9,000 in back child support. Eliminate the ex, and his financial obligations would die with her, thus a money motive, said the prosecution. And then they brought it up. Sex, or rather, Shannon's love life, not the sex life the defense had in mind, but the romantic kind that sometimes produces jealousy, the other age-old motive for murder.
Ms. Starbuck, now a single woman, dating other men. Much to the chagrin and dismay of the defendant, Clay Starbuck.
Shannon's newfound romantic freedom enraged Clay, said the prosecution. One of the couple's friends testified that Clay seemed unnaturally obsessed with his ex-wife's personal life.
He basically gave me a litany of things about Shannon.
about what she was doing and how she was seeing lots of other men.
And one of the kids' teachers testified that she heard Clay predict something that sounded to her quite chilling.
He said, I wouldn't be surprised if we found her dead. I wouldn't be surprised if we found her with her throat slit open.
Then, the view from the detectives, who testified how it seemed to them Clay was just a little too eager to direct their suspicions away from himself and towards some anonymous online lover.
I don't very often have people pushing at me a piece so much that it pushes everything else, all the other information out. It was just constantly pushing that at me.
Jealous, resentful, and on the morning of December 1st, luring Shannon out of her house with a phony story about a broken-down car. Remember, Clay texted Shannon, asked her to take the kids to school, then shut off his cell to avoid detection. Or so said the prosecutor, a killer laying a trap.
Getting the children out of the house, staking out the house, entering the house, waiting for Miss Starbuck to return.
They played that snippet of a 911 call that the prosecution said confirmed the time of the attack.
911, what are you reporting?
Then an expert told the jury about the DNA they found on Shannon's neck.
Is this YSTR match that you described an exact match to Clay Starbuck and the male bloodline of his family?
Yes.
The DNA had to be Clay's. He was the one with the weak alibi, and detectives had already cleared his sons, though the prosecutor called them as witnesses anyway.
During the school week, what time would you normally go to school?
It was just after 9.
On December 1 of 2011, did you work that day? It would have been Thursday.
Yes, I was.
And someone else, investigators say, was cleared by his alibi. John Kenline, the married teacher, was forced to appear. Admit he'd been unfaithful with Shannon.
We engaged in a sexual relationship, yes.
But Kenline was not here to be shamed, but to testify about curious messages he received from Shannon's phone. Messages sent long after the 911 call.
And again, sir, could you read that?
Did you stop by? ? Do you want to come over tonight?
Those messages found on Shannon's phone, investigators believed, could only have been sent by Shannon's killer.
And by this time, you believed she was dead.
Right. Based on the 911 call, we believe she's deceased, and yet someone is using her cell phone to communicate.
And to prove it must have been Clay who sent those messages, they entered into evidence this seemingly innocuous text message from around 3 p.m. that afternoon.
At 3:06... p.m. Shannon Starbuck's phone to Logan Starbuck's phone. Send Marsh a note. Dad will be there in 10 minutes.
Send Marsh a note? Who besides his mother might know the nickname Marsh? The youngest Starbuck, Marshall, came to the stand. No video of the minor allowed in court.
How often would your dad call you Marsh?
A lot, and he also called me son and Marshall and
But he did call you Marsh a lot?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it had been an intimate act. An angry ex-husband killing the mother of his children, then staging the scene as a humiliating sex crime. Premeditated murder, said the state. And as evidence of Clay Starbuck's twisted state of mind, the prosecution offered this final piece to the puzzle. Detectives said they found Shannon's death certificate on a wall in Clay's house, pinned up like a trophy.
As a reminder, she's no longer in my life, and she's no longer going to cause me any misery or pain.
So, no smoking gun, but a pile of circumstantial evidence, deep enough, the prosecution hoped, to bury any chance of acquittal.
At the heart of this killing, and I would submit the motive, greed, anger, obsession, and jealousy.
And through it all, Clay and his defenders waited to tell an entirely different story about a risky life and an unsolved murder. Unsolved, the defense would argue, because investigators blew it right from the start at the crime scene.
They swabbed the face of the cell phone, and they got DNA. It's not his. The phone doesn't have Mr. Starbuck's DNA.
Whose DNA did it have? Clay Starbuck, on trial for murdering his ex-wife, had something big in his corner, something he believed would establish reasonable doubt. Shannon's laptop computer. It held evidence, he said, of his ex-wife's dangerous secret life.
We're talking about casual encounters with people who aren't using real identities.
In fact, Shannon's own children were convinced that one of those men must have been her killer.
And make no mistake, there were men that she talked to the day before.
That was the story the defense and the children were poised to tell in court. And then, a ruling from the judge. The evidence was inadmissible. The children's stories, the activities revealed in the laptop computer, the evidence pointing to other men Shannon knew intimately. It was all too speculative, said the judge, too prejudicial. And it was out. The jury wouldn't hear it. Suddenly, at the defense table, the air went out.
I think the court was thinking, we don't want to make this a forum to run somebody who was murdered down. Unfortunately, this isn't something that's just being made up. We didn't create this, these allegations.
Clay Starbuck's lawyers needed a plan B. So, they went after the murder investigation itself, pointing out in court all the things investigators failed to do.
On the right hand, they found on one of the nails what tested positive for blood. They don't test it. They don't even look at it. In fact, you will hear from the crime lab that they intentionally swabbed around the blood.
It was a recurring theme for the defense. They didn't test it. Evidence collected but untouched by lab techs. And under cross-examination, Detective Ricketts was pilloried for making the decision.
Did you direct anyone to collect any piece of evidence from the master bathroom that would be consistent with that crime scene?
No.
As far as you know, have you or have you directed anyone to have those items tested?
No.
And if there was any potential trace evidence or any evidence on that, we don't know.
We don't, right.
The crime lab didn't test it.
Right.
But there were also issues with the evidence that was tested, said the defense. That cell phone, for instance, the one the prosecution went to great lengths to say Clay used after killing Shannon.
They swabbed the face of the cell phone, and they got DNA. And they got this DNA, and it's not his. Unidentified male. The phone doesn't have Mr. Starbuck's DNA.
And more unidentified DNA found on Shannon's neck, where she was strangled.
Fair to say, going back to the term match, that there was another contributor on the sample reference Ms. Starbuck's neck, male contributor, that has not been identified.
Correct.
Whose DNA was that? The defense asked. No one knows. But the presence of male Starbuck DNA at the crime scene, they said, was no mystery at all. Not only had Clay lived in that house, but the DNA could easily have been transferred by children going back and forth between parents, as young Marshall explained. And again, only his audio could be recorded, not his face.
And do you ever share clothes with Austin now?
If, like, all my shirts are dirty or something, I'll borrow one of his shirts. And I use some of Blake's old sweatshirts.
On the matter of the alibi, neighbors in the area where Clay Starbuck claimed his car broke down testified that they did see a car matching that description parked by the side of the road.
Well, I came up. I go out early in the morning to smoke a cigarette outside, so I haven't seen it parked up the street.
Well, Austin told the court that the jury should not be suspicious about Clay's phone being off that day.
Why would he have it off?
So he wasn't interrupted when he was sleeping because he just had back surgery and he needed his sleep.
Yes, the back surgery. The reason Clay was in Deer Park and not up working on the pipeline at the time of Shannon's murder. Clay was simply too weak, said his kids. Didn't have the physical strength to kill their mother.
So my mom, she's 5'10", 5'11", 180 pounds. That's not a small lady. You know, she's not big, but she's not small.
Debilitating surgery?
That's correct.
Absolutely, said Clay's doctor.
He would probably still be somewhat limited 4 months after surgery, yes.
Austin also addressed that so-called trophy the prosecution brought up, Shannon's death certificate, supposedly hanging on Clay's wall. It was actually his, said Austin. As executor of Shannon's estate, he needed copies of the death certificate, and he wanted to keep one safe where it wouldn't be lost.
And where did you put that?
The master bedroom my dad stayed at, in the closet we used for a gun safe that was behind a key lock door handle.
But the star defense witness? Clay Starbuck himself.
Mr. Starbuck, you were married to Ms. Shannon Starbuck at one time?
Yes.
Speaking in calm, deliberate tones, Clay told the court that his back surgery had forced him out of work, which is how he came to be more than $9,000 behind in child support and alimony.
I couldn't do anything about it until I went back to work. That was my goal.
Money was no motive, said the defense. And as for jealousy, not him. His talk about Shannon's online dating had been misconstrued.
Why did you tell people about that information?
Concerned and see if we could help her.
Some of the witnesses, especially the officers, testified that you had told them about the same sort of activity after the death of Ms. Starbuck.
Yes, and they were interested in anything that could help them with the investigation as well.
Okay.
So that's why. Yeah.
On the stand, Clay Starbuck patiently followed his lawyer's lead. No gaffes, no slip-ups.
Mr. Starbuck, did you kill Shannon Starbuck?
No, I did not.
Thank you. No further questions.
And when it was over, Clay and his defense team felt so confident, they encouraged him to talk with us about the case and some things that did not come out in court. In an exclusive interview, Clay Starbuck explains why he believes he's about to go free.
The case has been botched in your view.
I would say botched is fair game. There's some smart people that have made some elementary mistakes.
On the stand, Clay Starbuck was one cool customer. Taciturn and stoic, practically Vulcan when pressed by the prosecutor on cross-examination.
Are you a jealous person?
Not at all.
Do you ever get angry?
Not at all.
Ms. Starbuck was granted 50% of your pension. Did that make you angry?
No.
Did it bother you?
No.
Do you think that Shannon Starbuck's killer was trying to send a message?
I don't know.
But make no mistake, Clay Starbuck has plenty to say about his ex-wife Shannon, about the detectives whom he believed ignored promising leads in order to hang her murder on him.
They were after me. They had their guy. They didn't want anybody else. They wanted to drive me to prosecution.
For starters, Clay Starbuck told us in an interview given near the end of his trial, the case against him is based largely on a faulty understanding of the DNA evidence.
It was not considered a match of DNA. It was not 100% match. It was not a full inclusion, nor could they exclude it.
The Starbuck DNA found is actually a partial strand that can occur in nearly 1 in 3,000 males in the U.S., according to the state's crime lab. Not nearly as accurate as standard DNA testing. Yet that evidence, said Clay, was blown out of proportion by investigators on a mission.
Mishandling of I can state a lot of things.
The case has been botched, in your view. Is botched a big word, or is it okay in this case?
I would concur. I would say botched is fair game. There's some smart people that have made some elementary mistakes.
But even if that was his DNA at the scene, said Clay, it proves nothing. He told us that not only had he slept in that bed for years, he'd been there since his breakup with Shannon.
I left
June of 2010. Was that the last time that Shannon and I were intimate? No, not even close.
Really?
Absolutely.
Feelings? Hopes of reconciliation, perhaps? No, not that at all, said Clay. He had moved on.
At the time of Shannon's death, I was seeing a gal in Valdez, Alaska. It was a long-distance relationship.
You were otherwise engaged.
I was otherwise engaged.
And he disputed all the nasty stories Shannon supposedly told her friends about him, wondered why detectives would listen to what he considered to be gossip.
She was terrified of you. And she told her friends this. And so when she winds up dead and humiliated that way, who else are they going to look at but the person she was terrified of?
Shannon's friends that you mentioned, if they make those comments, I don't control those comments. I have no way of knowing what Shannon told them, but I would hope that they would follow the evidence. I would hope that they wouldn't chase somebody down over a comment made off the cuff.
And those were secondhand stories about Clay the jury never heard anyway. As for his alibi that morning and the surveillance video that appeared to destroy it, proves nothing, said Clay. Of course the camera didn't show him on that street, he said. He never told the cops that's where he walked, and they never asked.
They didn't ask you where you went?
No.
Because they say you told them.
I did hear that.
What are you saying? That their memories are bad or...
or something.
That they're lying or what?
There's been many statements in this that have not been true from law enforcement standpoint.
And speaking of alibis, Clay said he doesn't believe the time of that 911 call means anything at all.
And it is so short, you can't tell what it is.
Yeah, but it's a call to 911. She winds up dead. They go together. So the time of death makes most sense right around that time. Just after, because she would have been under attack at that point.
I don't see how, with any of the evidence that's been provided and statements by witnesses, that anybody can make that assumption that a 911 call at a quarter after nine and her death were exactly related.
For more than 2 hours as he talked to us, Clay Starbuck remained unflappable, quite determinedly so.
I can see why he'd be a very hard guy to argue with.
Actually, I'm an easy guy to argue with because I don't argue.
That's the problem.
Makes
you crazy.
It doesn't make me crazy.
No,
I just don't care.
Other person crazy.
Well, then I suggest you get counseling.
Never angry, never jealous. The only emotion Clay Starbuck pleads guilty to is disappointment. He was disappointed, he said, when his youngest daughter told him about some explicit images she had seen on her mother's computer.
It's pretty upsetting for you.
It was disappointing. I wouldn't say upsetting.
Now, according to Clay Starbuck, murder never crossed his mind.
She was a beautiful woman, smart woman. She didn't need to travel those paths to find men to be with. It was senseless.
And did you try to stop that behavior by killing her?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I wouldn't kill her. I wouldn't harm her. I wouldn't kick, bite, scratch anything her. I've never done anything to her, and I didn't kill her.
He faltered once, only once. The question was about his children.
What have you wanted to say to them all these months?
Well, you're going to end up making me get emotional, so I'll just leave it as I'm just very proud of them.
Pretty tough thing for kids to handle.
It is. It is. Not only did they lose their mother, they lost their dad for a period of time.
Maybe forever.
It's not going to be forever. It's going to be till next week.
Clay Starbuck was, he said, a confident man, quite sure that acquittal was just days away. All he needed now, he said, was to hear the jury say those words, not guilty. The verdict and the emotional fallout.
I jumped up and I screamed. I screamed.
For more than 2 weeks here in Spokane, Washington, discussions about the Clay Starbuck murder case sounded a little like political debates these days, polarized. And as the judge sent the jury off to deliberate,
You'll now be escorted back to the jury deliberation room.
Shannon's two families, her mother and siblings who believe Clay had poisoned the children against their mother, on one side of a great divide.
I hope that they learn the truth.
And those very children on the other, wanting nothing more than to have their father come home.
I hope after all this is done, I never see a courtroom again.
But of course, it was only those 12 strangers who could decide. And the hours went by, and people close to the question on both sides were in some kind of agony.
I was sick to my stomach. I was nervous. Knowing what I know, and in my heart, I know Clay did this. All it takes is one person not to believe, and we have to start all over again.
Not easy for any of them. But Austin had an especially difficult task. A new father himself, and now, after fighting with his uncle and grandmother over custody, he was guardian of the three younger children.
Hello.
And until this moment, he had been, said his siblings, like a rock. Funny how these things sneak up on a person.
If you could speak to your dad and just say one thing, the two of you, what would it be?
See you soon.
I haven't even thought about that. I miss him.
And then they were all in court, their opposing wishes on full display. The jury was back.
As the jury reached a verdict,
they had been out one full day. Here was their decision.
In the matter of State of Washington versus Mr. Clay D. Starbuck, verdict form A, count one reads, we the jury find the defendant, Mr. Starbuck, guilty of the crime of premeditated murder in the first degree.
Guilty. His face looked like stone. But something else going on inside, said his lawyers.
How was he when that verdict happened?
Shocked.
He actually thought he was going to be acquitted.
Absolutely.
But Shannon's mother and siblings finally felt vindicated. All along, they believed it was him. And now a jury agreed.
As soon as that first guilty verdict was read, it was like a ton of bricks were lifted off of us.
I got the text, guilty. I jumped up and I screamed. I screamed. I was like, yes, yes.
Clay Starbuck was sentenced to life in prison. All five Starbuck kids say they still believe their dad is innocent. Led by Austin, head of the household, weight of the world on his shoulders.
You know, it's not over yet.
But he was convicted.
Yeah, but there's still appeals. There's still other things we can do.
Well, that may be so.
So, you know, it's still not over.
So, parent and siblings satisfied with the result? Children not at all and vowing to fight on. And Shannon's friend Summer? Hard to know exactly how she was feeling.
I thought it would bring me more peace than it did. I was relieved that he was found guilty, but it didn't bring me the peace I thought it would.
Justice. Sometimes what feels like justice to some doesn't to others. Not at all. But this we can say. Once there was a fine and lovely woman whose life was good and useful, who loved her children.
They were her world. And no matter what had happened, what was said, what's been done, what's been drug up, that she loves them and she wants them to be successful and have good lives.
No, she did not deserve the way her life ended on that cold December morning in Deer Park, Washington.